Cool. All right. Well, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, and that's Tim W. from Santa Barbara.
Thanks, Glenn. My name's Tim Woodcomb. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, Tim.
And I'm grateful to be sober today. You know, they say alcoholism is a disease of perception, and it struck me when Laura said, talked about your beautiful voices, because I was sitting there thinking, man, it's a good thing these people's sobriety doesn't depend on their ability to sing. You know? I just like to make friends with the crowd right away. You know? Happy birthday. Congratulations. I want to thank Glenn for doing his job, doing it well. You get asked to do these things, and sometimes you got to call people and say, am I still supposed to be there, or where is this place, or, you did your job well, and I appreciate it. You know, I get these calls often enough that it doesn't surprise me anymore, but I always take a moment to reflect and think that I can't remember one jail, one penitentiary, one nut house I was ever in where anybody ever said, hey, Tim, you want to get up and talk for about 30 minutes? You know, I used to do it occasionally, but especially if the meds were right. But, but nobody was asking for it, believe me. I'm sober since January the 3rd, 1983. Very grateful for that. I have a home group. It's men who have lost their legs. We meet on Thursday nights in the Veterans Memorial Building in Santa Barbara, where I live. Any of the men in this room would be more than welcome to join us. 8 o'clock Thursday night, Veterans Memorial Building. Please, if you're down our way, come and see us. It's a good group of guys. And I have a sponsor. His name is Jim McNally. And I find a certain humor in the fact that Jim used to be a Superior Court judge. Something I said? Anyway, I find a certain humor in the fact Jim used to be a Superior Court judge. I never appeared before him personally, but I do know some of his colleagues. He's a good guy. He's a keep it simple, easy, does it kind of. We get along well. You know, I do this often enough that one of my favorite parts of the whole thing is I like to eat, and I like to, so I usually go out to, usually try and have somebody with me, or people with me, or meet people. So I want to thank my friend Lee for telling me he knew I was coming up and did I want to go eat. And I want to thank my friend Eddie for joining us, and I want to thank my friend Bruce for coming along. There's what usually happens to me is somewhere, you know, I'm really enjoying myself because there's food and there's companionship and fellowship, and we're having a good time, we're talking and we're laughing and we're doing that AA stuff, and somewhere right in the middle of the meal it hits me, oh no, I gotta go talk. Anyway, I'll try and make it as painless for you all as possible, you know. My experience in sobriety has been that there are these things that just kind of come up topics in meetings. You know, you go to a meeting and for a week, and every time you go, the topic is forgiveness, or it just, there are things that seem to present themselves in my life, and recently it's been acceptance. You know, I send out a daily email to a big list of people, and the one last night or from this morning was from Dr. Paul's story in the book about, you know, it used to be 449, now it's 3 something or other. He says, my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. And then, you know, and I think, yeah, that's good. I'll send that one out. And I'm feeling all spiritual and stuff. And then something will happen, and I realize, oh, yeah, wait a minute. You know, I probably ought to practice what I'm actually talking about, you know. So, my friend Bruce that rode up with me is a good friend, and I manage our central office in Santa Barbara. I'm the special worker in that service center, and Bruce volunteers down there and is a big help to me and much appreciated, and I always want to mention that and let him know for sure. You know, my life sort of depends on volunteers, or my level of acceptance or, you know, serenity or whatever. And I want to thank Eddie for showing up. I've known Eddie for a long time. And can I tell him a little bit? Yeah. You know, Eddie just celebrated being out of the penitentiary for a year. He's been out now. And so all the years prior to that, 26 of them, I was seeing him in there because I have a panel at that prison that I've been doing for a long time. So it just, when I see anybody that I've known for that long out here prospering, doing well, involved in the fellowship, doing exactly what, you know, what we usually suggest to them up there is that, look, when you get out, if you're an alcoholic, come to AA and do it right away. Don't think I'm going to go as soon as I get my life squared away. Make it the first thing you do, and you'll find some help. And I've watched Eddie integrate himself into this society and into this fellowship up here. Got a job, and he's got a place to live, and he's driving a car. And, you know, it's just like, man, these stories just do my heart well. You know, I'm an ex-convict myself. I had an A number, if that means anything to anybody. So, so long before I ever took a drink of alcohol or used any of those other substances of which I was so fond, I'm standing on the schoolyard at Cohasset Street Elementary School, maybe third grade. I'm with my little crew. You know, one of the guys says, hey, man, try this. He says, squat down, take a bunch of deep breaths, stand up and blow on your thumbs. I said, why? What's going to happen? He says, just try it. You'll find out. Well, this was to establish a pattern in my life, this whole just try it, you'll find out thing. You know? But I did it, and I passed out because that's what happens when you do that. And I came to him laying on the blacktop, the world's spinning, I'm all disoriented. Wow, cool. Yeah. Everybody else in the little group did it, and then they all ran off to play dodgeball. I stayed there and did it 8 or 10 more times. Let's face it, if it's good, let's do a bunch of it. So I didn't start out, you know, neither of my parents were alcoholic. They did have the occasional drink, and I'm sure at some point I said to my dad, he had a drink in his hand, and I asked him if I could try it, and he handed it to me, and I thought, oh, God, that stuff's terrible. You know, I never did really come to enjoy the taste of alcohol. but of course I learned about what it could do for me. So I, even at the end of my drinking, at a time when I'd set up light housekeeping under the bridge, I tried to have some water with me to taste of that stuff out of my mouth. So I started with those outside issues that we talk about sometimes. You know, I was running around with these guys that were older than me, that I looked up to, that were sort of my role models. They were motorcycle guys, Satan slaves, and one of them especially was a friend of mine, his little Joe. And we went out riding in this car, and he said, "Man, you got to try this." So there's four of us in the car, and he lit up a joint. We started passing it around, and it was that old Mexican dirt weed that, four-finger lids and all that business. So he had to smoke a lot, you know, and I'm going, "Hey, I don't feel anything. I don't feel anything. I don't, whoa, I feel something." We took off riding in that car, and I'd ridden in it many times before, and I knew it didn't have any shocks or springs, and now all of a sudden we're on these air cushions, you know. We're doing a fast 15 miles an hour down the street. And went to a place that called Beep's Hamburgers on the corner of Sherman Way and Woodley in Van Nuys. Place is still there. And this is how long ago it was. They were selling hamburgers 5 for $1. And I had $1's worth, because they had changed the recipe. Man, I had never tasted anything that good in my life, you know. Oh, my God. It wasn't long after that somebody gave me a handful of pills and said, "Try these." And I went, "What were they?" And he said, "Those are 10-grain benzedrine tablets." I said, "What's going to happen?" He said, "Just hang on." Man, let me tell you the story of my life in detail. Yeah. I shot my first heroin when I was 18 years old. Loved that. So, you know, I liked the speed a lot, because one of the reasons I didn't care a lot for drinking besides the taste of it was when I did drink, I always got drunk. Now, that's not a surprise to you people, but, you know, I wasn't clicking that there was a difference in the way that I consumed alcohol from the way people around me were doing it. I'm sure, you know, there were people that went to the drive-in movie on Friday night and had their two little cans of Country Club stout malt liquor and copped a buzz and stopped. I mean, I drank everything in sight, and then I was drinking yours, and I just, you know, it didn't register, but I didn't drink the way other people drank, or a lot of other people drank. So I always got drunk. So with the speed, there was at least some illusion of control. You know, I could do it without getting stupid and falling down and getting sick on myself and getting beat up and all that stuff. So I had just turned 19 years old when I shot and killed my older brother. I say it was a fight over drugs. It was really a fight over the way I used drugs. We'd had a lot of fights in our life. And, you know, he was bigger and meaner and always won. And I was tired of getting beat up. And I had we got in a fight and I had a pistol and I used it. I was convicted of the crime of second-degree murder. I committed that crime while under the influence of alcohol and narcotics. Say I had an A number, I went upstate. Many things happened while I was in the penitentiary. You know, I had a lot of experiences. I didn't draw a sober breath if I could help it, and I could usually help it. You know, the state of California was doing a lot of better living through chemistry in those days, so they were prescribing stuff to alter our moods and behaviors, and I would take what they prescribed for me, and I'd take what they prescribed for him, and him, and him, and, you know, mix all that stuff together, and let's see what this does. And we were smuggling drugs in. We were making wine. There were crooked cops that were bringing stuff. You know, there was a lot of dope. It was easier to get dope than it was alcohol. But I stayed loaded most of the time I was inside. what turned out to be one truly important thing happened while I was there. I was getting ready to lock up for count, and this guy that celled next to me said, "Hey, man, you go to that writer's group, don't you? Aren't you a member of that writer's group?" I'm like, yeah, well, I'm a poet. He says, "Well, you know what? I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you come to my meeting? I'll come to yours and we can spread our hustle." Sure. So I went to my first AA meetings while I was doing that number. I didn't go because I was an alcoholic. I went because it got me out of my cell, because there was coffee. Free people came in from outside. Some of them were women, you know, real women. And, you know, and I sat in my back with my yard coat all buttoned up to my neck, wearing my shades at night, and I came to scoff, and I did not remain to pray at that point in my life. I thought it was good for the people who were there, because I listened to their stories, and thought, man, they obviously don't know how to drink. But that wasn't my problem. My problem was I'd had a series of bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances, and people who didn't understand. You know, the problem was all out there. And what I've discovered, as long as the problem's all out there, I can't do anything about it. So I did not get sober at that point in my life. I got paroled, I got a habit again, I started drinking more and more and more, until eventually, 1982, I'm homeless on the streets of Sacramento. I'm supporting myself by petty thievery when I'm not too drunk, and when I am too drunk, which is most of the time, I beg for money on the street. And I hated doing it, and I did it all the time because I didn't know what else to do. And I approached the last friend of mine who was still speaking to me, and she took me over to her mother's house, and they made up a little job. It was just made up. I moved some boxes around. I swept her garage. She gave me $20. I spent half of it on wine and half of it on a bus ticket to Chico. And I did what all tough guys like me do when you're in a situation like I was in. I went home to my mom. And I arrived at mom's drunk, as I had many times before. And when she answered the door, I said to her with all of the arrogance of the practicing alcoholic, "Don't worry about anything, Mom. I'm here to take care of you." And Mom said, "I'm sorry, son, but you're dying. You're killing yourself, and I can't stand to watch it. So if it's what you have to do, you have to do it somewhere else." And she gave me $20. And I spent half of it on wine and half of it on a bus ticket back to Sacramento. And I rode away thinking, what just happened? You know, my ace in the hole. Because you can always go home to Mom's. This is another, you know, in a series, a long series of bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances. Now even Mom doesn't understand. I'm not trying to hurt anybody, you know. I mean, people would tell me I was drinking too much, but I thought that was their problem. So I was tramping around with this guy named Bob the Wino. We were drunk somewhere, and he looked at me and he says, "You know, we're dying, you know that?" "Yeah, I don't care. Just taking so long." He says, "I'll tell you what, man, I get a little money at the first of the month. Why don't we go to Santa Barbara and get sober?" And I said, "Sure." Now, he could have said, "Why don't we go to Denver and get drunk?" And I would have said, "Sure." You know, I had focused in on the fact he got a little money at the first of the month. You know, this is new information. But he was a man of his word. First of the month came, he got his little check. We bought us bus tickets. We rode down there. We were drunk on the trip and drunk in that town for a couple of days. And we got separated. We got separated because he felt the urgent need to go somewhere and I was too drunk to walk. So I watched him weave his way away and realized we hadn't made any real solid plans for how we were going to meet up again. The next morning I came to behind a business somewhere in Santa Barbara. I have no idea to this day where I was. All I know is some guy was pushing me with his foot going, "Hey, hey, you can't sleep here." And, you know, I got up and grabbed my bedroll. I went and found some weeds. I laid down again and passed back out. I came to later and had that thirst on me, you know, that thirst. And I went and got something to drink and started thinking about, we need to find Bob. So I look in the phone book and there's Alcoholics Anonymous. On the trip down, he said, "We'll go to AA meetings when we get down there." I went, "Oh yeah, AA, I know about that. I went when I was in the joint." I didn't really know anything about it, but I thought I did. But I found the number in the phone book and I made that call. You know, that call. Woman answered the phone and I said, "Have you seen Bob?" She said, "I know a few Bobs, honey. How are you doing?" We talked briefly. I went and drank some more and then I walked up there to what turned out to be Central Office. I didn't know what it was. But there was Gertrude. She said, "Oh, you're that man looking for his friend. I still haven't seen him, but I know some guys that would like to talk to you. What do you think?" "Sure." She wrote out some directions. I left Central Office. I found a bar. I went in and I had, as I recall, 3 drinks. And I had those drinks because I had a sneaking hunch I was on my way to get sober. You know, guy needs some liquor in him if he's going to do something like that. I walked up to the club. Somebody met me. "You Tim?" "Yeah." "Oh, yeah, we've been looking for you." I got 12-stepped out of the book. I realized later, you know, that these guys that talked to me were talking just the way it outlines it in our book, that we should talk to people. And I haven't had a drink from that day to this one. You know, a couple of things happened. You know, I checked into the Salvation Army, to the ARC, the Adult Rehabilitation Center, and God bless the Salvation Army. They got me up off the street level and gave me a safe place to be. But prior to getting in there, the first day I was completely without a drink, I had spent the night at the homeless shelter and heard them talk about the ARC and ask what's that, and they told me. And I said, "You think I could get in over there?" They said, "Well, look, here's what you do. You don't have a wallet. We know that because we checked you in last night. You don't have any ID." He said, you go to the unemployment department and you register for work and they'll give you something with your name on it and that will serve as a means of identification for you. I said, "Well, you know, I'm really not looking for a job." And they laughed at me and said, "You know, no, go do what we're telling you." So I'm standing in line waiting to get this piece of paper. And I did something that was unusual for me. I told this guy standing behind me what I was doing. You know, there may be some, possibly, maybe, perhaps, I got some little problem with alcohol. And I'm trying to get into the Salvation Army. And he says, "Oh, let me pray for you." And he put his hands on me and started praying out loud. In front of other people. And here's how I know that I was really bottomed out, is I just stood there. I know that any other time in my life I would have said, "Get away from me, lame. You know, what do you think?" I mean, I would have had some reaction because I would have been embarrassed. But I just stood there and took it. And I haven't had a drink from that day to this one, so I don't know. You know, I got into the ARC. I called my mom. I said, "Mom, I'm in Santa Barbara, California. I'm living at the Salvation Army. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I could hear her go, "Oh." I said, "I like it. They're nice people. They're kind. but they do talk about God. And she said, oh, that shouldn't be a problem for you, son. Ever since you were a little boy, you've had a sense of wonder about the world. Yeah. Good old mom. You know, in many ways, that's still, you know, I know people here real well. As I said, I know a few people real well, and none of us are drinking tonight, and it gives me a sense of wonder about the world. You know, it does. Rooms. Oh, my God. Hello, Roger Brown. Come
here. Don't pay attention to this.
That's my friend Roger. Anybody that doesn't know him. Roger's been out 6 years now. Six and a half, excuse me. Did 34 inside.
34 and a half.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to take any of that away from you, you know. Has his own business, has his own house, has his own vehicles. Roger is one of... Roger and Eddie both are, when I think about them, just fills my heart. You know, their success stories and due in large part or perhaps maybe totally to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And both of them try and give back, which is the secret of, you know, how this program really works. So I got involved in hospital and institution work fairly early in my recovery. I went to the places that they would let me go, which were not too many, but they would let me go to some where you didn't need to get cleared. And I started that work. My sponsor was into it, and I got into it early. You know, as I say, I've been out of prison so long, they let me go back in now. Been going for a number of years. So I started going to CMC. And I'd been doing that work for a while, and I was at a convention in Santa Barbara, an AA convention, and we were I think it was the Al-Anon luncheon. And I found myself sitting next to this guy, and we're talking a little bit, and I said, what do you do? And he says, oh, I work at the United States Penitentiary in Lompoc. I said, oh, really? I've been trying to get in up there, but they won't let me in. You know, I'm cleared in the state system, but the feds don't. And we started talking, and anyway, the end result of that was my friend Lee, who was working for the feds at that point in the penitentiary, hand-walked my papers into the warden or the associate warden or the captain or somebody and said, hey, he was running the recovery program there in the penitentiary. He said, here's the guy we want to get in here. And they said, no, we don't. And he said, yeah, we do. So, you know, just, I never, you know, thank you. I still go in, not as much as I used to, but the nature of that institution has changed too. When I was going, we call it the golden age of recovery at the United States Penitentiary in Lompoc. There was a group of guys, a good solid group of guys, maybe 25 of them, and Lee had a lot to do with that. He, as I say, he ran that recovery program in there, and he knows all these hotshot speakers, so he would get them to come up and speak on Friday night, and then on Saturday morning, they'd go into the pen and talk there. So these guys, the convicts, had a joke about, you know, hey, you want to hear the best circuit speakers in the world, all you got to do is get locked up in the federal penitentiary. And, you know, you'll get Clancy and Johnny Harris and Sharon Barker and all these people. Yeah. So Lee and I have remained friends ever since. I'm grateful for his friendship. Billy Norris is here. And, you know, when I was 15 years sober, I got a job running central office in Santa Barbara. I had been working for a company for about 12 years and thought I'd be there forever, and then I got injured on the job and I had to lay out. So when the time came for me to go back to work, I realized I probably didn't want to go back to what I'd been doing. And the chairperson from Intergroup approached me and said, "Hey, we need a new manager at central office. You think you want that job?" It's like, "Yes, I do." So I did that for about 12 years. And somewhere during that period of time, my friend Billy said, "You know, we need to start an office in Santa Maria." So he was very instrumental in making that happen up here. You know, you develop these friendships, and you develop, there's a fellowship that grows up around you. And great deal of gratitude for the people that I know, the people in my life. I retired from that job, and my wife said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Nothing, I'm going to be retired." She said, "Yeah, but what are you going to do?" I said, "Nothing, you know, I'm going to go to my panels, go to my meetings, play a little golf. I'm going to be a retired guy." She said, "No, you find something to do." I guess the idea of me sitting around in my underwear watching Gilligan's Island wasn't nearly as, you know, nearly as attractive to her as it was to me, but she said, "You know, you always talked about when you were a kid you did some acting and how you thought you'd like to do some more. She said, why don't you go up to City College and take an acting class?" So I went and signed up. Scared me to death because I had quit school in the ninth grade completely unscarred by education. You know, now I'm going to college. But I'm taking these acting classes, and I met some people, and they said, "We're doing this play, why don't you come and audition?" And I went and auditioned, I got a part, and I fell in love with the whole process. So my wife and I formed a little production company, and we started putting plays on in Santa Barbara, and the first one we did was Bill W. and Dr. Bob. I got to play Bob, the role of a lifetime for a guy like me. So 2 years ago, chairperson of Intergroup came to me and said, "We need you back at the office. We're having a lot of trouble." So that's what I've been doing for the last 2 years, is I'm back running that office and managing the office. And as I say, I have a volunteer staff. The reason we have volunteers at central office, in case you don't know, is because you can't get paid for 12-step work, and I'm getting a little check for what I do. So I have people that come in and freely and completely, you know, give themselves without compensation to be there to answer the phone in case an alcoholic calls and needs some help. And we're so grateful for the volunteers. You know, I mentioned H&I, right? If you're new, I want to welcome you, tell you what I was told when I got here. That is, you're welcome in this fellowship. You're not alone anymore. You don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. I believe that now because it's been my own experience. You're not alone anymore. You don't ever have to drink again. There is a way of life that is, I have found to be full and rich and rewarding, and you know, it's an experience to be sober and to stay sober. And they say if you can manage not to drink and you can survive the fellowship, you're going to be okay, you know. Because, you know, there's times for me when personalities come way before principles, but I learn from these experiences, and I grow and I change, hopefully. So if you're new and you're looking for something to do, let me suggest H&I, Hospital and Institution. It's not for everybody, but for those of us who do it, we love it. We love it a lot. 98% of the people who do H&I work stay sober. That's a statistic we made up ourselves. But I can tell you this, everybody I know that does H&I work stays sober. So, and you get to have these experiences, you know, going into CMC. I'm up there at a meeting, and this guy comes up and he says, "Hey, man, you ever see these chips? Say, like 90 days on them? Not the metal chips. We can't have metal. These look like poker chips." I'm like, "Yeah, I've seen them. I work at central office." He said, "Well, can you find out how much they cost, where we can get some?" It's like, "Sure I can, but what do you want with a 90-day chip? I know you. You're 12 years sober." He says, "Oh, no, man, it's not for me." He says, "The thing is, there's a whole cell block full of guys here who have alcoholism and problems other than alcoholism. They're bipolar and manic depressive and schizophrenic, and they won't let them out of the cells to come to this meeting. So what we've started doing is we're taking meetings into them, because that's how we do our H&I work, man." We got them the chips. Every once in a while, one of those guys gets to feeling better and he shows up. "Look, man, I got 90 days. So I'm sitting at the office one day, central office, and the volunteer hasn't shown up. So I get to answer the phones, which I love to do, but I got to take myself off the clock mentally, you know, at least. The phone rings and I pick it up, and this woman says, "I wonder if you could help me. I came to town yesterday with a friend of mine. And she got hurt. She's in Cottage Hospital and she's still not ready to get out. And I had to spend last night in a motel and I really can't afford motels. I'm not in any danger of drinking. I'm 12 years sober, but I just feel like I need somebody to talk to. Can you talk to me?" "Absolutely. However, I'm here alone. The other line's ringing. Let me put you on hold. I'll get right back to you." I picked up the other line and a young woman said, "Can you help me? I can't seem to stop drinking. I don't know what to do." And I connected line one to line two. They came by the office later that day. The newcomer was doing all right because she was getting the message carried to her. The one with some time was okay because she'd quit thinking about herself and she was thinking about this new one. You know, that's what you guys taught me. When I can take my mind up off myself, all my bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances, and the people who don't understand, when I can give a moment of thought to you and your welfare, I'm always better off for it. I want to thank you for listening tonight.
Yeah. All right. Let's give Tim another round, huh?